We are attempting to understand better how God pre-revealed in the Old Testament so many things about what was going to happen in the New. And the fact that the Old Testament was written and circulated, and copies of it even exist today that were made before by several hundred years, anything that actually happened in the New Testament is just a part of the testimony, the evidence, that this book is far more than just a book of men. You see, in general, men, in order to predict the future, have to do a little fudging. They have to wait till it happens and then pretend they predicted it ahead of time in order to be infallibly correct about it. Not so the Bible. That some of the things we've been looking at already have shown that God prepared far ahead to show without a shadow of a doubt that this was from Him. And a great example of that is what we looked at last week as we saw how Jesus fulfilled the Passover. Let me call your attention to a passage of Scripture. In Acts chapter 17, we have Paul on his missionary journey. I think this must be his third missionary journey. And as Acts chapter 17 begins, it tells us that Paul is traveling in what is today the nation of Greece. And in Acts 17, verse 1, he arrives in Thessalonica. Now later he will write two letters back to the Christians and the church that he helped start in Thessalonica. We have them in our New Testament, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. But right now he's there for the very first time in Acts 17. And it tells us that when he passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. As his custom was, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. "This Jesus I'm proclaiming to you is the Christ," he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and not a few prominent women. So he goes into Thessalonica and he finds a Jewish synagogue. Paul was Jewish. His entire upbringing, both culturally and religiously, had been Jewish. And it wasn't until he had met Jesus on the road to Damascus, while he was on his way to arrest and imprison and persecute Christians in Damascus, that he was converted to being a Christian. And now he devotes the rest of his life to traveling about, teaching both Jews and Gentiles about Jesus. But notice this, what he's doing here. He goes into the Jewish synagogue. There he's going to find people who are not Jewish racially or culturally, but who are devout religious Jews. These are the people who every week hear the teachings from the Old Testament. They are the ones who, more than any other Jews, were looking for the coming Messiah. They were, more than any other Jews, the ones who believed that everything God wrote in the Old Testament had some meaning about the Messiah. Now, God never actually said that anywhere, but that was their belief, that everything in the Old Testament, in addition to having some historical or legal or other lesson, also taught them something about the coming Messiah. So he goes into the synagogue, and for three Sabbath days, they allow him to teach them from their own Scriptures. And what is he teaching them from their own Scriptures? Their Old Testament. Or what we call the Old Testament. They didn't call it that. He's teaching them that the Messiah, the Christ, when he came, had to suffer and rise from the dead. Now, to say rise from the dead means he had to die. He had to suffer and die and rise from the dead. So first of all, he demonstrates to them from their own Scriptures that that's what the, as we call it, Old Testament taught. That they had missed that. Their emphasis had been for so long that when the Messiah comes, he will reign on a throne and drive away our enemies. And yes, that's what was taught. But they had missed a whole nother part of what the Old Testament taught. And that is that the Messiah had to be a sacrificial lamb who died for the sins of his people. And after he died, it was taught in those Old Testament scriptures that he would rise from the dead. Now, for most of us, the passages that first spring to mind that teach that in the Old Testament is Isaiah 53, a passage that talks about the lamb led to the slaughter, but then he would see his life again, it said in Isaiah 53. But there are other passages that also teach that in the Old Testament. And as we looked last week, the Jewish people every year celebrated a series of festivals, holy days, holidays, we would call them, that God had ordained. Those were specified in Leviticus chapter 23. There were seven of them. And right now we're looking at the first three of those, because those first three were all celebrated within a couple of days of each other. Now for us, we might say, why would God do something like that? We kind of like our holiday spread out. We don't want to lump together Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and the 4th of July all within just 3 days of each other. And yet that's exactly, in a sense, what God had done for them. He had told them that in the spring of their year, in the very first month of their religious holiday calendar, that they were to celebrate three different festivals or holy days within a period of less than a week. That on the 10th day of the first month, and their first month was called Nisan, on the 10th day of the first month, they were to set aside a lamb, each family. And on the 14th day of Nisan, on the 4th day after that, they were to take and have that lamb killed, and it was to be roasted, and they were then in that evening, which would be the beginning of the 15th of Nisan, because for Jews, a new day began at sunset. And so in that evening, after having killed the lamb on the 14th of Nisan, they are to celebrate the Passover, which commemorated what they had experienced as a people in Egypt, when God, bringing on the 10th plague on the Egyptian nation and the Pharaoh, declares that among his own people they would take a lamb and to kill it and take the blood and put it over the doorpost, put it on the doorpost of their houses and roast that lamb and eat it that night. And while the Egyptians were in grief at the death of their firstborn, they ate a memorial supper to remember that God had passed over them when he saw the blood. And they were to immediately begin preparing to leave Egypt, because the next day they're going out. They're going to move from slavery to freedom. They're going to move from being the slave class in the nation of Egypt to being a nation of their own, a nation belonging to God. And as they go out, they were to go quickly, such that they did not have time to even take the bread or the ingredients for the bread that they would make and let it rise by having yeast and leaven in it. And so immediately after celebrating Passover, they began a period of 7 days, which then came to be celebrated as the days of unleavened bread. It began at the same time that the Passover took place, and it would go for 7 days. And then God said, because I'm taking you out of Egypt, I'm going to take you to a land I'm going to give you. And when you get into that land and you settle down and you plant your crops, the very first year when your crops, particularly your grain, begins to ripen, then I want you to take the very first of that barley grain that is ripened and celebrate another day, a holy day. And this day, which was the holiday of the first fruits, is to be celebrated on the first day after the Sabbath day that falls in the middle of the 7 days of unleavened bread. Now, if you can keep up with that, what that basically amounts to is they kill the lamb for Passover on the 14th and ate it on the 15th. And on that same day, the 15th of Nisan, they celebrated 7 days of unleavened bread, which would take them up to the 21st day of Nisan. But of course, that all means that there's going to be a Sabbath day in there. It falls on, I guess, the 16th of Nisan, or 16th. And then the first day after the Sabbath would be the 17th day of Nisan. And God said on that day, the 17th of Nisan, once you get to the land, you start celebrating a one-day festival of the first fruits. That may seem all very confusing to us. But it's just like our holidays. Once you get used to when they are and what you're doing, then they just come along year after year and you celebrate them. But what does that all have to do with Christ? Well, it turns out, as we saw last week, that on the 10th day of Nisan, as the Jews were taking their lambs and setting them aside to examine them for 4 days to make sure they were without flaw before they killed them on the 14th of Nisan to have their Passover, on the 10th day of Nisan, Jesus makes his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. He hadn't been to Jerusalem for 6 months. This is his first return in over 6 months. And on that very day, the 10th of Nisan, he makes his appearance in Jerusalem. And day after day, he makes himself publicly available at the temple and in the city for people to examine him, even his roughest critics. And they found no fault in him. And then on the 15th of Nisan, in their holiday, after he himself celebrates the Passover festival, he is arrested that same night and tried and the next day killed, and his blood is shed. See, Jesus died right in the middle of the Passover. And the scriptures tell us he is our Passover. When Paul is talking to the Thessalonians there in Acts 17 about showing out of their own scriptures that the Messiah had to suffer and die, I don't think he just used Isaiah 53. I think he used their own Passover. Later, he will write a letter to the Corinthians, another city in Greece that he visited during this same period of time. And he will write to them in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7 saying, Christ, our Passover. Paul saw the connection between the celebration of the annual Jewish Passover, remembering that Old Testament event, and saw the connection between that and Christ being our Passover. The Lamb of God being killed, His blood being shed, and His blood saving His people and creating a whole new nation who's come out of slavery into freedom. Down in Acts 17 and verse 10, we find that even though Paul teaches these people in Thessalonica that it's actually more non-Jews who end up believing him and becoming Christians than the Jews. Isn't that interesting? That the Gentiles could be persuaded by Paul's arguing from the Jewish scriptures. This lets us know that in that day and time, those who weren't even Jewish were very impressed by the Jewish scriptures. And they're persuaded by the teaching of Paul. That's why it says that, as we read there in verse 4, that some of the Jews were persuaded, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks, and more than a few prominent women. But nevertheless, there's so much persecution that arises after this among the other Jews that Paul actually has to leave town, and he goes on down to a much smaller city in Greece by the name of Berea. And things are quite different down there. It says in Berea in verse 10, as soon as it was night, the brothers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. On arriving there, they went to the Jewish synagogue. Now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians. It's actually not saying here all Thessalonians or all Bereans. He's actually talking about the Jewish component, I think, in those cities. But he says that the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians. What made them have a more noble character? For they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. Many of the Jews believed, as did also a number of prominent Greek women and many Greek men. The reception in Berea was even more overwhelming than it had been in Thessalonica. What was the difference? According to Luke, as he writes this, the difference is, while Paul reasoned with them out of the Scriptures up in Thessalonica, down in Berea, as he reasoned out of the Scriptures of Bereans, instead of finding objections to what he's saying, they were examining the Scriptures to see if what he was saying was really true. If Paul said, look, it says in our own law that we celebrate this Passover and we do this and this and this, and yet this is what has happened to Jesus. He came in to Jerusalem on the 10th of Nisan, and he was examined for 4 days, and he died during Passover, and his blood was shed. And the people in down in Berea who are Jewish and have scriptures are looking at it and says, yes, that's what happened in the Passover, and you're telling us that's what happened to Jesus now? And because they had this predisposition to believe that everything written in their scriptures somehow also talked about the Messiah, they could see that. And as a result, instead of a few Jews becoming Christians, as in Thessalonica, it says many of the Jews believed, as well as many of the Greeks who frequented apparently the Jewish synagogue. And all we're looking at now, as we looked at the Passover, and now today we're going to look briefly at the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Feast of First Fruits. What they were doing was they were looking at those things in the Old Testament and seeing how they ended up applying to Christ. And so that's what we want to do. What were they seeing, and what was Paul preaching from the Old Testament that was so convincing to them? We've already looked at the Passover and how Jesus fulfilled that. Let's look at these other two festivals that they celebrated. Perhaps they had always seen, like we would, that cramming three different festivals together so closely would be a great inconvenience. So there must be some reason God had for putting them all so close together that had nothing to do with our comfort. The Passover we see because it was a celebration of something that actually happened on a specific day in their history. It was on the 14th day of Nisan that God had actually sent the angel of death out and had passed over Egypt, and those firstborn had died, and yet the people who had the blood on their doorpost had been spared. It was actually anchored on a specific day, just like our July 4th is anchored in a specific historical event in our history, and so we celebrated on that day. You know, some of our holidays we tend to move around, but this one was on a specific day because of a specific event that happened. And so also the second one, this Days of Unleavened Bread, because for the next 7 days they were to eat no bread with leavening in it, because it commemorated the fact that from that time, for 7 days, or at least for quite a long period of time historically, they didn't have time to sit down and let their bread rise. They had to eat it in haste. In fact, they called it the bread of affliction. It was the bread of affliction because it was the bread of Egypt as they came out of Egypt, but it was also a bread that not only commemorated the suffering they did in Egypt, but even the struggle they had as they got out. It was a bread of affliction, the bread that was unleavened. It would make something more akin to our tortilla today than the nice bread with yeast in it most of us are used to eating. And yet, that's what they ate during that period of time. Even today, Jewish homemakers, in preparation for their celebration of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, 7 days of no leavening, go through a ceremonial search throughout their house and a cleaning of their entire house to make sure there's not one bit of leavening of any kind in their house. They find any old bread or any bread at all they have in their house that has leaven in it, it's all gathered up and thrown out. They will actually clean their kitchens, clean their cupboards, sweep their floors, go through their entire house to try to make sure there is no leavening of any kind in their house in preparation for celebrating these 7 days of unleavened bread. How was eating unleavened bread for 7 days somehow a foreshadowing of Christ? We can see how it tied in so specifically and uniquely to their exit out of Egypt, their exodus out of Egypt. For it represented how they had to leave in haste and eat the bread of that haste, the bread of affliction. But how did it represent Jesus? Well, first of all, think a little more generally. And again, it's not within the nature of our Western minds where we've been taught mathematics and science and to think, quote, logically, to necessarily see these things. But we need to realize there's more to the world than just logic and science. And that God is a God of emblems and symbols and premonitions and foreshadowings. And so we find as we look at the life of Jesus, we find some things already that might be pointing in a certain direction. Take, for example, where he was born. We know the prophecy, born in Bethlehem. What was so strategic about that in this whole subject is that Jesus' parents-to-be were not living in Bethlehem. They were living up in Galilee. Even though his mother, Mary, is pregnant by the Holy Spirit, not from the man she's engaged to be married to, Joseph, nevertheless, he will end up being the legal father of Jesus. They have to, if Jesus is going to be born in Bethlehem, somehow they're going to have to go from Galilee down to Bethlehem. And God accommodates that by moving the emperor of the Roman Empire to declare that everybody has to go back to their hometown and register because it's time to update the tax rolls. And apparently there was only a certain limited amount of time you had to do that because Joseph felt compelled to go with his wife-to-be Mary down to Bethlehem while she is in the latter stages of her pregnancy to do it. He has to obey the law. And they arrive in Bethlehem just a few days at the most before she actually gives birth. And Jesus ends up being born in Bethlehem. We know that story. Maybe what you don't realize is what the word Bethlehem means. Bethlehem means the place or the house of bread. Isn't that something? Why would God insist on him being born in Bethlehem? Well, we know that was the birthplace of David, and he's going to be a descendant of David, and we're probably usually satisfied enough with that explanation. But Bethlehem was the house of bread. That's what it had meant from the beginning of its existence. But there's more. As Jesus began his ministry then, there was more than one occasion when he fed large crowds of people with very little food. Just a few loaves of bread and some fish. And in particular, as we have in John's account of one of those times when he feeds more than 5,000 men plus women and children with just a few loaves of bread and fish, after he feeds them, he then wants to teach the crowd. And what does he teach them? That he is the bread from heaven. Where did that teaching come from? He talks to them how God had fed their ancestors in the wilderness after they came out of Egypt. He had fed them manna for 40 years, bread from heaven. But he wants them to understand that he is the real bread from heaven. And so he's born in the house of bread. He tells people during his teaching that he is the bread from heaven. And then on that night, as they are celebrating the Passover, and he's going to be arrested later that night and carried off for trial and so forth, we have this concerning him. This is in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 17. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, that makes it pretty clear because the Passover and the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread fell at the same time. But on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" So here's those two holidays mentioned together. And he replied, "Go into the city to a certain man and tell him, 'The teacher says, my appointed time is near. I'm going to celebrate the Passover with my disciples at your house.' So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them and prepared the Passover." We covered all of this last week. "When evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12. And while they were eating, he said, 'I tell you the truth, one of you will betray me.'" And so they have this discussion about who is it. And Jesus actually identifies which one of them it is. But it seems that only he and the betrayer knew what he was doing. And so in verse 26, "While they were eating, Jesus took bread, gave thanks, and broke it." Isn't it interesting? Now, they've eaten a lamb that night. There's roast lamb, mutton, we would call it, on the table that night, and they've eaten that. But Jesus didn't take a piece of the lamb and say to his disciples, "Take and eat this. This represents me." To me, that would have made the most sense. But then he's not going to do what, to me, would make the most sense. He's going to do that which was in God's plan. And so what does he do? It says here that he took some of the bread, this unleavened bread, gave thanks and broke it and gave it to his disciples saying, "Take and eat. This is my body." the man who was born in the house of bread, who told people that he was the bread from heaven, here in the at the very beginning of their celebration of the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Passover, takes that unleavened bread, breaks it, gives thanks to God for it, and then hands it out to his disciples and says, "Take and eat it. This bread is my body." To any Jewish mind, if what Jesus is saying is true, this connects what is happening here with what happened back there in Egypt that night at the Passover and the beginning of the days of unleavened bread. Jesus is saying that he is fulfilling both the Passover and the days of unleavened bread in what's happening to him. So how was the days of unleavened bread a foreshadowing of Jesus? That unleavened bread represented his body. Yes, it also represented what they had to eat in their haste to get out of Egypt. But it also represented his body. Proceed to the Jews, they had a long-standing belief that even though while they enjoyed leavened bread, bread with yeast in it, they also saw on a spiritual level that yeast represented corruption, even wickedness. And according to some of the rabbis, the worst, the greatest evil that leaven represented was pride. And so when they ate the unleavened bread, they ate it in humility and in obedience to God. And Jesus says, "This bread is my body." They had examined Jesus and found no fault in him. In taking the unleavened bread and saying it represented him, he was saying, "Here is the bread without any corruption in it. Here is the bread without any sin. Here is the bread without any pride. The bread of humility. The bread of obedience. The bread of affliction that they ate." And so they ate the bread of the feast of unleavened bread that night. And Jesus said it represented him. He's taken, arrested, tried, even by the Roman governor who said on four different occasions, "I find no fault in him." He truly was unleavened bread. Nevertheless, he was sent to the cross. In that twilight, he was crucified about 9 in the morning. By 3 in the afternoon or a little after, he's dead. His blood has been shed. His life has been given. It was in the twilight they always kill the Passover lamb. He's taken down from that cross, hastily prepared for a temporarily prepared for a burial and put in a borrowed tomb so that by sunset he's not only dead but buried. For the Jews have several things they're trying to do at once. They're not at least, you know, the unbeliever Jews are not the least concerned with Jesus fulfilling prophecy or their own feast. And certainly Jesus' own disciples couldn't see it yet, and so they weren't either. But the Jews were busy getting him down off the cross and getting him into a tomb because they had to celebrate their Sabbath day, which was coming at sundown. But wait a minute. There was this other feast they had to celebrate the day after their Sabbath, called the Feast of First Fruits, because it was the beginning of the harvest time in their nation as well. And so the first thing on Sunday morning, the way we speak about the first day of the week is Sunday morning. The first thing on Sunday morning that happened up at the temple was that a presentation was made in which a basket is brought to the high priest, and that basket is filled with barley grain. It's grain that's just been harvested out of the fields. It's the very first grain they could find that was ready for harvest. And it's brought up before the high priest, and it's presented to him, and an animal sacrifice is made. They actually go through three sacrifices at once. They make a wave offering, a thank offering, and a peace offering, all at this time. The wave offering says, "God has given us what we have, and we give some of it back to him." The thank offering says, "We thank God for providing us with the things we have." The peace offering says, "We are in a covenant relationship with God, and we honor that, respect that peace we have with him through our covenant, through this sacrifice we're making." So first thing, Sunday morning, each year, on the day of first fruits, they made this offering. But something else was happening early on Sunday morning as well. Matthew 28 and verse 1. "After the Sabbath, at dawn, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. And there was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven, and going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. And his appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were as white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him, they shook and became like dead men. And the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He's not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he did lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him." Even as they're making sacrifices for the feast of first fruits up at the temple, Jesus rises from the dead. Coincidence that it happened not just on the same day of the week, but on the same day of the year? I don't think so. And the passage that Don read for us in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. What did it say? Verse 20, "But Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep." And then again, a couple of verses later, it says, verse 22 and 23, "For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive, but each in his turn. Christ, the first fruits, then when he comes, those who belong to him." For over 1,000 years, the Jews had celebrated the harvest of first fruits. A celebration that said, look what God has given us. And over the next 50 days or so, 6 or 7 weeks of their harvest, it also sort of looked forward to say, look what God is going to give us. And then at the end of those 50 days, they celebrated a fourth festival we'll talk about next week called Pentecost, which marked the end of the harvest and was a celebration of what all God had given them. They'd been celebrating that for 1,000 years and did not know that they were also celebrating that on the first day of that week, God was going to raise Jesus from the dead, the first fruits from the dead. Yes, there are others that have been raised from the dead. We've looked about the Shunammite's son in 2 Kings. We've read about him being raised to life by Elisha. We know Jesus raised several from the dead, a synagogue ruler's daughter, a widow of Nain's son, Lazarus, among others. But there's a difference here. Each of those who are raised from the dead in the Scriptures died again. And they had another funeral for them. And they remained in the grave. But Jesus, when he rose from the dead, never died again. Death had no more hold over him. He was alive forevermore. Now, what does all this have to do with us? Jesus was bread without leaven. That was represented in the feast they celebrated. But we as his people also are to be without leaven. That same passage, 1 Corinthians 5, 7 and 8, that said talks about Christ as our Passover, it says that we are to be without leaven in our life. And Paul is speaking in the immediate context of some sin that was in the church at Corinth and how they needed to purge it out, get it out, because they needed to be unleavened bread as Christ's people. And when he rose on the first day of the week, not only was that vindication of who he was and fulfillment of the Feast of First Fruits, it was God's promise that he would raise us from the dead. When they brought those first barley grains up to the temple to say, this is the first of the harvest God has given us physically, agriculturally, and then it was sort of the promise of what was still to come. So Jesus being raised from the dead was God's promise. There's more to come. He will then raise us from the dead. There's a whole lot more here than we've ever seen. God was doing so much more than we ever imagined. He was telling his people long before it happened that he was going to not only take a perfect lamb and cause its blood to be shed to save his people and make a nation out of them, but that he was going to be unleavened bread and that on the day of first fruits he was going to rise from the dead. There's more to come.